You get dickheads in any society.
I never said that I thought it would be bad.
Are you high now?
Yeah.
Hello, Tom Tilley with you for Hack. Can you spot a fake news story when you see one? Millions of people were duped by fake news stories during the US election last year. Today, learn how not to get caught out.
Hack. Our rent is probably 45% of my income. This year we're all going to be wearing onesies at home so we don't have to put the heater on.
Triple J.
Have you had trouble finding a place to rent? If you're living on Centrelink, it's basically impossible. The latest Anglicare rental affordability snapshot revealed there were just 29 properties in the whole country that were affordable for people living on youth allowance or Newstart. As Shalila Medora reports, even some people earning a full-time wage are really struggling.
I get about 520, roughly, in pay. 340 of that goes to rent.
Adam Owens is 26 and on Newstart. Every day is a juggling act.
I can't even afford to buy my own fridge. I have to buy stuff, like buy food for that day, basically.
Spending cash on his asthma inhalers could tip him into the red.
I have to choose, basically, whether I eat that day or end up in hospital. Because, I mean, if I have an asthma attack, I could potentially die. I mean, I'm not trying to be a drama queen. I'm just, you know, basically stating the facts.
Adam's story is the devastating reality for young people who rent while on income support, things like youth allowance or Newstart, according to welfare group Anglicare. They teamed up with realestate.com.au to look at how much you fork out in rent.
We say that if you are in the bottom 40% of income and you are spending more than 30% of that income on rent, you are in rental stress.
Casey Chambers, who heads up Anglicare, said rental stress is particularly bad for young people.
Out of all those 67,500 properties, only 8 would be affordable if you were on youth allowance right across the country. 21 if you're a single person on Newstart.
From Bunbury to Brizzy, Wyala to Wagga, finding a cheap place to rent is near impossible.
Nowhere in the Northern Territory, in the ACT, in Queensland, in any of the major cities, was there anywhere that was available for somewhere on youth allowance.
And before you say, why don't they just get a job? Well, that doesn't really change things much.
Only 2.8% of them even would be affordable for somebody on a minimum wage.
Rachel has a job.
Sorry, I'm going to cry.
She's the main breadwinner in her house and supports her husband and 2 kids.
Our rent is probably 45% of my income. This year we're all going to be wearing onesies at home so we don't have to put the heater on. That's how close we are.
It's the 8th year Anglicare has run the snapshot and things have been going south for a while. But this year parents who are on minimum wage, that's about 35 grand a year, are doing it especially tough. Casey says part of the problem is that the private rental market is skewed towards landlords.
Where is the rent? I must have the rent. Dollars, dimes and nickels, I need them all right now.
So low-income people put up with crappy accommodation and rent hikes to avoid ending up on the streets.
Yeah, we would like to see a rewriting of a balanced contract between landlord and tenant.
Anglicare also wants the money that goes to tax breaks, like negative gearing, redirected to build more affordable housing.
So that's $8.6 billion annually going out of government money, which is taxpayers' money, to private investors. There is the money in the housing pot, but it is currently structured in tax cuts for investors.
PM Malcolm Turnbull said he'd look at it in this month's federal budget.
All of these matters will be dealt with in the budget.
But he's sticking to the party line that tax cuts aren't the cause of the current crisis.
The government has absolutely no doubt that the solution to greater housing affordability is to build more dwellings. There's particularly a problem in Sydney and in Melbourne, and in both cities it has been the consequence of there not being enough construction of dwellings.
And as for the proposal to increase welfare to ease rental stress, opposition leader Bill Shorten is open to it.
So Labor's got a series of plans from reviewing the Newstart allowance through to improving supply, through to getting a better deal for renters and people in public housing.
Hack on Triple J with Tom Tilley.
Shalila Medora reporting there. Love to hear your stories. A few people texting in already. Enough of the sob stories. I study a master's degree full-time, work 35 hours a week and play sport at a high level. Work harder or move somewhere you can afford. Someone else says, good evening, Hack. Read your story on young people not affording rent at the moment. Can I suggest move to Gladstone in central Victoria? Hundreds of houses lying empty, mostly brand new, that can't be rented. I'd love to hear your story. Are you struggling to find a place to rent? How tough is it? And what are you doing about it? Are you maybe moving home with your parents or moving town? Give me a call. 1300 055 36 is the number. Pat, how's your struggle?
Oh, mate, it's pretty bad at the moment, to be honest with you.
Where do you live, yeah, and what's going on?
I live in Cairns, and you know, I work in construction, and if I just do a base 40-hour week, you know, nearly half of my wage goes to the rent.
Wow, and they say rental stress is anything over a third.
Yeah, my missus stays home because we've got two young kids, so she stays home and looks after the kids.
So what are you doing about it? Are you just battling with it?
Just battling, mate, and you know, we're actually in the process of moving house at the moment. You know, we've lived in a house for about 3 years, but the lessor wanted to sell it, so now we've got to move out of this house, and the only house we could sort of find within an hour's range of where we're living now, we're paying an extra $80 a week rent.
Yeah, sounds tough. Thanks for the call, Pat. Bryce, what's your situation?
I'm out of it now, but I was living in Maureen. I was an apprentice, and I was living out of my own in a flat, and like I had, it was solely just my wage, and over half my wage went on just rent, and like it got that ridiculous trying to keep up with bills. Like, I don't condone it, but yeah, I didn't do it myself. Yeah, we stole to eat. Like, that's how bad it was. It was ridiculous. And that's sort of where I'm up to. And
yeah,
I'm out
tough
of there now. And,
okay,
yeah.
So how did you get ahead?
I don't know. It's sort of, we sort of just managed it, and yeah, but it was bad at one time. Like, I got paid at one stage when I first moved out $470 a week, and I was paying like $150 just in rent, and that's straight rent and not food, and I had to put away for electricity and my car, and like, it was pretty tough.
Managed to do it, so yeah, somehow you got there. Any tips for anyone listening now who is in the situation that you found yourself in a few years ago?
Just keep going, I guess, and
hit the boss up for more money.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, well, you're an apprentice, so that's pretty tough, as any apprentice would know. Thanks so much for calling in, Bryce.
No worries.
Love to hear your story as well. Are you finding it hard to find a rental place? If you have found a way to balance the budget or to find a cheaper place, we'd love to hear from you. Any solutions, welcome. 1300 055 36 is the number. Lots of you have responded to this story by saying that, of course, you can't afford to rent a place if you're on the dole, but many students are also on Centrelink, and there's over 1 million uni students in Australia right now. Stuart Martin helps some of them out. He works for Victoria University. He's also the chair of the Student Financial Advisors Service. Stuart, this rental snapshot confirms a particularly tough story for uni students.
It does indeed, but it's not a new story. It's been going on for years and years. It's just getting much, much harder.
Yeah, it seems to be getting worse. Pull out a stat from the snapshot here. Housing affordability has deteriorated for single people living on a minimum wage, with the number of suitable houses falling from 5% of the survey to 2%. So basically, it's almost halved the number of available houses for people earning that much money.
And traditionally, Australian universities haven't provided student accommodation for students, particularly those students who have to move from regional and country areas to universities, which are predominantly based in big metro areas or in large towns. So there's just not the accommodation there. And those universities who have some student accommodation, it's still very, very expensive. And if you look at the youth allowance and Austudy recipients, they get indexed their payments once a year, whereas Newstart and all the other payments are indexed quarterly. So youth allowance and Austudy are the lowest paid of all income recipients. It makes it really difficult for them to be able to afford to move to the city to study. If you want to change your life, you have to move. You can't rely, and not everyone can rely, on their parents paying for that to happen. To move to the city and find accommodation and to pay for it, particularly in your first year of uni, and this also affects apprentices who have to move from the country to the city, you need cash. I'm not talking a couple of thousand. We're talking $5,000 to $8,000, maybe sometimes $10,000 to set up a home. How many people can afford to do that? Not many.
So for students, it's often about balancing the money you get from Centrelink, mm-hmm, with your workload at university, the study load, and then what you can earn in a part-time job. Yes. So what advice do you give young people that come to your Victoria Uni in Melbourne?
It's about looking at their personal situations first and seeing how they spend what little money they have, and then trying to match them up with ways they can maximise the money they have. And I might be saying, okay, you can't really afford to stay in student accommodation. Share accommodation is invariably the most cheap form that you'll get. It's not as cheap as people think, but it's a lot cheaper than some uni accommodation that's provided. It's about just trying to work with them individually. There's no one straight fix for every student, unfortunately.
And do you have any ideas for solutions for the government? I mean, we heard Malcolm Turnbull say that, you know, it's mostly about building more buildings, supply, but a lot of young people are sick of hearing that.
Well, building a house isn't going to work for a young person moving from the country or someone who has to travel across Melbourne, say if you live at Frankston and you go to VU. That's
but new apartments would, and I mean, that's what he's talking about as well.
New apartments, if you look in the city, Brady Group, which is an international company, are coming and building high-rise city apartments for students, aimed at international student market.
More lucrative.
Far more lucrative. They're not price pointing them at the point that students can afford to pay or even their parents can afford to pay. The solution is, I think, to go back to the Rudd and Gillard government had at the National Affordable Rent Scheme. It was a program where the government gave money for people to build subsidised accommodation. And it had an effect, but not a very good target effect. It was meant to help people who are from low socioeconomic backgrounds to be able to afford to move into rental properties. It was a great idea. There wasn't enough money of it, and it stopped, and it was poorly targeted. Now, if universities could access that money, and some universities in the regions could, they were able to set up subsidised accommodation. But what happened was some universities said, oh, well, you know, we'll do it, but we'll charge greater rates. Across the world, we are the only Western nation that does not expect our students to move away from home and study. New Zealand does it, the States, Canada, England, they all expect their students to move away. We don't. Students are losing a vital opportunity to learn some soft skills about being independent. It's driven by the fact that they can't go and move to another university because they can't afford to live there, and there's just not the accommodation available around universities.
Yeah, and it's, I guess, borne out in the figures of more and more people staying at home longer, living with their parents. Yeah, it's a tough one, Stuart. Great to hear some advice directly from a student advisor. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hack. The news is broken, but we figured out how to fix it.
On Triple J.
All right, let's play a game. Which one of these headlines is fake? The Pope has endorsed Donald Trump as the US president. Well, this one, FBI director receives millions of dollars from the Clinton Foundation. Or ISIS leader calls for American Muslim voters to support Hillary Clinton. Well, the answer is they're all fake news, and stories like these were read by millions of people in last year's US election. So now that we're a little bit more aware of fake news, are we getting better at detecting it? Well, as Joe Lauder finds out, a writers' organisation in Philadelphia is running workshops that teach kids how to spot fake news.
It was hard to know what to believe in the US election. Did the Pope endorse Donald Trump? Was Hillary Clinton really running a pedophile ring out of a pizza joint? One believer was so convinced by that story that he took a gun there.
He drove to DC from North Carolina to, quote, self-investigate Pizzagate, a fake story alleging Hillary Clinton and her campaign chairman, John Podesta, were involved in a child sex ring at Comet Ping Pong.
At Hack, we even got texts from listeners who believed that story.
She runs a pedophile ring, and there is plenty of proof if you look for it.
Are you going to explain how the Clinton Foundation is a front for corrupt satanic pedophile rituals?
Again, the story is not true. There is no evidence.
Since the US election, fake news has been making headlines around the world.
With the challenge and threat of fake news, fake news, fake news.
Once upon a time, facts were facts and news was news.
Don't be rude. No, I'm not going to give you a question. I'm not going to give you a question. You are fake news.
It's not only an American problem. An Oxford Uni study has found a quarter of the political links shared on Twitter about the French election were spreading misinformation. And some British politicians are getting nervous about fake news swaying their election in June. Facebook has promised to do more to stop fake posts.
The news is broken, but we figured out how to fix it.
And this week, the founder of Wikipedia has launched his answer to fake news. It's a website with fact-checked stories and no ads.
So it's time to rethink the gatekeeper, and we call it Wiki Tribune.
So, how can you pick up on fake news? Which, by the way, is not just news that you don't agree with. It's a completely fabricated story.
Fake news is something that is put out to intentionally deceive.
That's Rachel Loper from the group Mighty Writers. It's a not-for-profit in Philadelphia that teaches young kids writing and debating skills. And around the election last year, they started getting lots of questions about the news.
There was a sense of, from the kids, of we don't know what is fact and what is fiction. How do you know? And I think when you're a young person, there's a danger of kind of throwing up your arms and saying, well, you don't know what is true.
Instead of letting them give in, they started running a workshop called Fake News Finders for 10 to 14 year olds.
We found it was really important to start to teach our kids and teens how to do the work of research and how to verify if information is actually true or not. We would talk about current events and we would look at those events by studying a variety of news sources and looking at the different ways in which the story is being told.
Rachel says in their workshops, they also give students a few clues to spot fake news websites, like bad design, scorched earth, literally, and no bylines on the articles.
You should always be looking for a high level of quality and design. The way it looks, if it's over the top, with, you know, a burning earth or something like that.
Rachel is pretty impressed with the news literacy of the students.
The kids knew a surprising amount intuitively.
But a recent study from Stanford Uni, which actually happened before the US election, isn't as flattering. The study found that 80% of students couldn't tell the difference between a real news story on the website Slate and their native advertising, which is basically ads that look like news stories. Picking up on bullshit news is even trickier when one of the most powerful men in the world is spreading it.
Overseas, it's emerged that an American aircraft carrier and accompanying warships have not sailed towards North Korea, as announced by the US President Donald Trump, but went in the opposite direction.
Hack. Alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Alternative
that there's
facts?
Triple J.
Joe Lauder reporting on the text line. It's very easy to spot fake news. Stop believing what your racist aunt says on Facebook. Someone else says, fake news is so much more interesting. Well, someone with a keen interest in fake news is the host of ABC's Media Watch, Paul Barry. Paul, thank you for joining us. These stories seem to have a way of really firing people up in a way that almost silences their critical thinking. Why is that?
I think they're designed to tweak people's emotions because people share stuff that gives them an emotional reaction. And the people who make fake news want to have it shared as widely as possible, either to make money or to spread their political point of view. So they're generally, or they are often, very, very catchy, hooky, well-designed stories. They are fun, some of them.
Yeah, well, often bad journalism or even sometimes good journalism is branded or labelled as fake news. What's the difference between bad reporting, good reporting that you maybe don't agree with, and fake news?
I think there was the woman in your report, excellent report there, defined it. Fake news is basically something that's not true, that is misleading, and that is deliberately so. So it's designed either for to be shared, either for to make money or for political advantage. But it's deliberate. It's not an accident. There's a lot of bad, sloppy reporting out there where people just get their facts wrong. This, the creators know they've got their facts wrong, or they are just completely reckless as to whether it's true or not.
Now, it seems to come at an interesting time where many other things are changing. There's, you know, a growing level of suspicion in mainstream political parties and the media outlets. We've had the rise of social media and big changes to the media industry itself. What do you think? Which came first? Like, there's so many factors here swirling around that I guess have potentially laid fertile ground for fake news.
Look, I think you've always had conspiracy theories. You've always had politicians or their proponents spreading lies to try and get them elected. So fake news in a way is nothing new. What is different is that social media and the internet are just absolutely magnificent at sharing it. So whereas once upon a time you'd have to go to a town hall meeting and put these rumours about, nowadays you can just launch it on the internet and it'll be around the world in 20 minutes. So it turbocharges the whole process, and it's incredibly... I mean, it's not for no reason that it's called going viral. It does spread like a virus, this stuff, because it is just so easily transmitted from one person to another. And people love to share these stories, and they are designed to be shared. And it's extremely effective. So it's really social media and the internet that has made this phenomenon possible.
Well, the US election is what really brought it to most people's attention. So I guess it's allowed us to wise up a little bit. Do you think that means we've broken the back of it and it will go away?
I don't think it's going to go away, because I think it. I think people believe it. You know, even when it's debunked, people believe fake news. I'll give you an example. There's a story Trump put out in the election campaign, a claim he made that Obama spied on him in the election campaign and tapped the phones in Trump Tower. He had absolutely zero evidence for this. It was denied by the White House and by Obama, denied by the FBI, and yet... A poll last week showed that more than 50% of Americans believe that Obama spied on Trump during the election campaign. Now, clearly that fake news has an effect, even though it's been debunked or there's no evidence for it. So people will continue to do it because a lot of people out there believe it, and also because people still want to share it, and so it makes them money from ads. And a lot of the motivation is to make money.
So I guess it's up to us to keep a keen eye out for what's real and what's fake. Paul Barry, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
It's Paul Barry, who's the host of Media Watch, which you can catch on ABC on Monday night just before Q&A. On the text line, The Batuta Advocate is great. Comedy, not fake news, just by the way, in case the boys are listening. Someone else says, surely it is a matter of only using verified, trusted media outlets and ignoring dodgy news sources. Simple, only trust a few sources. That's not as easy as it sounds, though, given there's so many different media outlets in the new media landscape. Someone else says, James, isn't fake news just a new age word for propaganda in the political space anyway?
Hack.
And this is home. This is what we are fighting for.
On Triple J.
All right, imagine starting a university or a school assignment. Then somehow it goes for 5 years, it takes you around the world and all the way to the Supreme Court in New South Wales. This is pretty much what happened to Holly Pfeiffer. She was studying at film school and started making a film about a PNG politician. Next minute, machine guns are out and somehow her main character ends up trying to sue her in court. It's a crazy story, and after all this mayhem, the opposition, which is what the film's called, is about to have its Australian premiere. Holly, thank you so much for joining us. How did this situation get so complicated?
Complicated to say the least. So I was in Papua New Guinea researching a political coup that was happening in the end of 2011 and the start of 2012, and was interviewing the leader of the opposition at the time. Her name's Dame Carol Kidu. And on my second day of filming, she got a phone call from a leader of the Parga Hill community saying that they were being bulldozed by policemen and that would she come down and help them defend themselves. And she looked at me with a camera and said, you want to come? And of course I said yes.
Tell us more about that moment, because it wasn't just one man getting kicked off a piece of land. As you say, there was a community and it ended up quite a hectic scene. Police were firing bullets.
Yeah, thankfully no one was injured in the gunfight, but there was dozens of policemen, some of them visibly drunk, and they were bulldozing ad hocly the residents' homes while their possessions were still inside. And there was a number of community members watching their houses go down, and they were peacefully watching. And I was able to film it. So once we caught that, we put 2 minutes of it on YouTube, and then we ended up making a film about it.
Stop the demolition. Just ask them to leave and let them take their houses down.
Well, asshole! Why was
it an asshole? Take her to the car.
And the woman you were there with, the politician, Dame Carol Kidu, was front and centre in that footage. She was there trying to stop the police from kicking out the locals who'd been living on this land for around 50 years. She was defending them. She came right up close to the machine gun-toting police and was defending these people. And somehow this is the woman you end up fighting in the Supreme Court years later. How did that happen?
I've been asking myself that same question for a number of years now. We're actually not sure why that relationship got so split, but Dame Carol was certainly encouraging of me to make the film at the very beginning, and she was involved in the filming for over 2 years. And when we were just about to have our world premiere at Hot Docs in Toronto in May 2016. Then we found out that she'd actually launched a case against us in the Supreme Court of New South Wales to seek an injunction against the film.
And the important detail of that backstory is that she'd actually changed her mind about the development after she left politics, and you were there initially filming her last 6 months in politics. She decided to back the project and actually work for the Parker Hill Estate developers in relocating the community. So she'd had a massive about-face.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about observational documentary is that it continually surprises you. So, as you say, at the very beginning of the film, Dame Carol is in the gunfight and stopping the Papua New Guinean police trying to bulldoze the houses at the Parker Hill settlement. And then a few years later, then she's working for the development company that wants to build a hotel and a marina wharf on that same bit of land. But she did still want to participate in the documentary. She was very reflective in our last interview together, which was after she became a consultant for the company. So we were able to capture that entire storyline within the film, and it is upsetting that then we ended up in the Supreme Court about it.
She had to put up a lot of money to stop your film getting screened last year, over $200,000. Do you know where that money came from?
Yeah, so through the courts, you can actually ask for more evidence to be produced so that you understand the whole story. And through that process, we found out that the Parker Hill Development Company were indemnifying Dame Carol Kidu on all of her court costs.
Very interesting. So what that really means is you weren't just fighting this former PNG politician, you were fighting her and a big development company, one initially film student.
Yes. So that was a very tricky situation because, you know, I am a documentary filmmaker, and anyone knows that documentary filmmakers don't have a large vault underneath their house. So, yeah, that was very tricky for us. But thankfully, you know, the funders of the film really stood behind us.
You're listening to Australian documentary maker Holly Pfeiffer. Her film The Opposition is finally having its Australian premiere at the Human Rights Arts and Film Festival in June. It's about a community in Papua New Guinea who were relocated to make way for a property development. And one of the main subjects in the film, as you just heard, tried to sue Holly, but Holly won the case in the New South Wales Supreme Court last year. Now, Holly, what are your views on the actual Parker Hill development and the relocation of the community? Because they were living on prime land in the heart of the capital of Papua New Guinea. Wasn't it inevitable that these people would be relocated one day?
Yeah, inevitable maybe, but I think the opposition really explores what the process of that is. The Parker Hill community, led by Joe Moses, was actually not anti-development. They were just very concerned about the issues and the processes of that development taking place. So he also wasn't anti-relocation. It's just that the options that he was offered, he didn't think were actually suitable. And the UN does say that if someone's to be relocated, then it needs to be the same or better standards as what they were living on before.
Okay, so here we are basically 5 years after that initial very dramatic scene that you filmed. Last year, the film was about to be shown at Hot Docs in Canada. Suddenly this injunction comes in. You have to get an actor to voice up the bits of the film that you're not allowed to show because of the temporary injunction. And then last year, you actually win the Supreme Court case. Now, finally, it's being screened here in Australia at the Human Rights Arts Film Festival. How do you feel about that journey now?
It's been a long one. Actually, it's only been last week that I realised it was a year since we've been sued. So a lot has happened. And in fact, we've just come back from Europe where we've had our world premiere. So we've been able to screen it around Europe, and now we're really excited to be able to bring it back home to Australia.
Holly, it's been fascinating to talk through your ride making this film and fighting through court and now finally having it screened. Thank you so much for joining us on Hack.
Thanks so much.
Hack. Triple J.
Holly Pfeiffer, an Australian documentary maker, talking about her film The Opposition. And the Parker Hill Development Company actually got in touch with us here at Hack, disputing the narrative of the film. They say it contains gross misrepresentations. And in a letter, the company said it presents a highly defamatory story that is seemingly plausible but is incredulously far removed from reality. The company says it carried out the first privately funded humane resettlement of illegal squatters in PNG. That included the donation of land, and that these are efforts which have been publicly commended by the United Nations. The film will be having its premiere on June 1 at the Human Rights Arts and Film Festival in Brisbane. You can also catch it at the Sydney Film Festival if you're in Sydney, and they are planning a series of screenings that may bring the film to a cinema near you. On the text line, sounds like an interesting watch. Sean in Canberra says, Holly, you badass. and we're still getting lots of texts coming in about housing affordability. We turn the bedroom into a room and rented out our back shed to make living affordable. Wow. Someone else says, the only way I could survive while at uni without starving was to live in credit. I was also sharing with three people. And yeah, certainly can lead a lot of people into debt. Thank you for all your calls and texts today. Remember, we'd love to hear from you if you've got a story idea, something you think is really important. You can send us an email, hack@abc.net.au. Thank you so much for listening. Good Nights is up next after the 6 o'clock news. I'll catch you tomorrow for the Friday Shake-Up.
Hack
on Triple J.